If you can tell me that it's faster and patient outcomes are better and it's not exorbitantly expensive, I'm all for that. Honestly, you know, that sounds simple, but it's tough to find.
Welcome to the Global Medical Device Podcast, where today's brightest minds in the medical device industry go to get their most useful and actionable insider knowledge direct from some of the world's leading medical device experts and companies.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Global Medical Device Podcast. My name is Etienne Nichols. I am the host for today's episode. Last week, I attended the LSI event in Data Point, California, where I want to say about 350 medical device companies came together to pitch to investors their product, you know, their early stage companies, and they're trying to get their medical devices to the market. Rewind a few weeks, maybe months. I was talking to my doctor, Dr. Lee Hunter, about a potential surgery operation, and I found out that he had started a medical device company. So with me today is Dr. Lee Hunter, a surgeon at the Mid-Tennessee Bone and Joint, although I think you've changed names. But before we get into that, how are you doing, Dr. Hunter?
I'm doing great, Eddie, and thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. The thing that really was interesting to me when we were talking is that you went through your medical device company or built a medical device, and you didn't really take on a lot of funding. And that's one thing I want to talk about. The other thing that really struck me about you is when we were talking, you know, and you were looking at the different things that I was doing, I noticed you speak two languages. One, you speak the language of how a physician has to talk to his client or patient. And then you said, now I'm going to say a lot of Latin. And then you did say a lot of Latin to your assistant, but you actually speak a third language, I'm assuming, and that is the language of business. So I'd be curious to hear your journey, how you've come to own a medical device and how all that went.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, it was kind of an overnight success, maybe 30 years in the making. You know, and I was fortunate enough to, what I would say, fail early in the process. And basically, when I was a surgery resident, I started having this almost kind of fetish with elbow surgery. And I had some ideas when I was a resident. We had a lot of bad elbows come through the trauma center. But we positioned them all in what's called lateral decubitus position to get the elbow. Well, the positioning took about 30 or 45 minutes sometimes of the case. And I was even thinking back then, I mean, I was just a kid, you know, that there had to be a better way. And then as time went by, I looked around and industry didn't solve my problem. And then I started doing a lot of elbow arthroscopy. Same thing, everybody, the people that did them lateral decubitus, and that took a long time. So I just started in the back of my mind trying to figure out a way to basically support a elbow vertically with the patient supine, such that you could do fracture care and arthroscopy. So I started designing some things, filed a patent application, got a patent issued, and I looked around for a company to help me with it, and crickets, right? Nobody interested whatsoever. And this, in their defense, this initial device was kind of clunky, and it was kind of a one-trick pony. It was great for certain elbow fractures, great for elbow arthroscopy, but it really was kind of a niche thing. And you know, there aren't nearly as many elbow cases out there as shoulder cases. You know, and also as a surgeon with a full-time job, you know, you have to, sometimes you can't even get in the door, right, to the right person. And back then there was not like the LSI conference that you spoke of. I'm sure those things were happening, but this was around 2008. Yeah. And they're not on my radar. I was not on their radar. So I ended up signing a licensing agreement with this general surgery company, basically. And they put this device together and presented it to me. And it was not really what I was, they tweaked the design a little bit. It wasn't really what I was after, but they ended up selling us several of these. And as time went by, I guess after a 2-year time period, I felt like it was just not going anywhere. So I terminated the licensing agreement, and I took what I didn't like about the device they created, and then I went down the rabbit hole again. And that's, and then several years later, I came back with this design that I really liked and I thought could really make elbow surgery better for surgeons and patients and facilities, just faster, better, easier. And frankly, I was so convinced of that, that I knew it was going to be a success. It just took me quite a while to convince everybody else.
How long did it take from the time you had the idea to the time you had the product that you wanted to be on the market?
We had the first commercial device of the device that I like, what I thought was where we needed to go in 14, I think, 2014.
Okay.
And that licensing agreement went from, I want to say maybe 09 to 11. Okay. So it took a few years off because I knew what I didn't like, but I didn't honestly know how to get there. I mean, just from a design strategy, because this, I was still tied up, you know, I had to have the design before I went back and funded it, however. But, you know, again, I was fortunate enough that licensing agreement, I would call it a great success, but really kind of a financial failure. The company probably didn't make any money off of it. I mean, I got, you know, very little, but it was great in that it showed me 100 different ways not to do something right. This is not what you don't want. This is, anyway, it was a great overall experience. Although my wife might not say so, but it was.
People probably pay more for an MBA than maybe what you did for the things that you learned, I would guess.
So, yeah. You know, it's kind of tough sledding there for a while, but really I was so convinced that it was going to change things and that elbow surgeons would love it that I just kept on chipping away at it. And I went from a real rough prototype that a friend of mine that owns a machine shop actually cut for me to then paying with my own money for someone to make a metal prototype, a stainless steel prototype that I'd actually autoclave and use.
I just want to touch on one thing you said. You didn't maybe those LSI conferences or other conferences were going on. Sometimes when I talk to people who have innovative ideas, it's almost like the medical device industry and the people who use those medical devices, they're kind of going along in parallel paths and they don't always cross over, or at least a lot of the people using those devices or have ideas don't know how to cross over to the other side. I'm curious what you learned in that process that if you could go back, you might tell your former self, hey, this would have made life easier if you'd done this, and this, or any thoughts come to mind?
You know, I honestly believe, Eddie, and I wouldn't have gone anywhere without that first licensing agreement experience, because I knew I had something. But again, that device, and it served its purpose, and we've still got an old version that I use down at our surgery center when all the others are tied up. But I don't think I would have been able to think through the process, right? I had to get so many data points before I got there. And keep in mind, during that licensing agreement, I wasn't spending any money.
Yeah.
You know, the company basically developed that for me. I would really say, have faith in yourself, but also have some awareness. You know, there's a difference between innovation and real innovation. And I love picking on the American Orthopedic Academies, right? Right. You go through their annual meeting. It's the biggest orthopedic meeting in the world. You go through this immense exhibit hall. And there's all these shoulder replacement systems and hip and knee replacement systems. And you could almost just kind of change the signs over each desk. I see a lot of innovative marketing campaigns, but, you know, really, is there a lot of innovation? I'd say not from my perspective anyway.
Just mild iterations. Maybe they made cheaper materials or things like that. Yeah.
You know, there is some innovation, but I'd say it's grossly overstated. You know, like the sixth iteration of a compression screw with a slightly different head pitch.
Right.
Is that really innovation? I mean,
yeah, it's or is it just continuous improvement? Yeah. So, and you know,
I would say, right. Very slight incremental.
Right.
Improvement, right?
Invalidating my life as a mechanical engineer.
Yeah, right. Not much disruptive stuff going on out there.
And there's another perspective, or it's almost like a pendulum swing. I mean, you have this over here where slight tweak is touted as a major improvement. But then you also have those companies who say, we're going to introduce AI or all these other things, characteristics into a product, which almost seems too revolutionary to where it's, we don't really need that. You know, and I don't know if you've seen that or not in the orthopedic space, but somewhere in the middle is what is the product that you had that not everybody is necessarily drawn to or maybe even recognizes as a necessity. So I'm curious how you were able to find that sweet spot, if you have any comment there.
I guess I had struggled enough with elbow cases just from a positioning standpoint that I knew what I was after, and I just got focused and I was committed to it. And, you know, your first sale is the hardest, right? So I made the first and I thought, wow, this is okay. But honestly, it was slow chipping. And we end up being, I think we got financially profitable maybe not till the third or fourth year in. I had a great focus on buying inventory that I thought I could sell pretty timely. You know, I didn't want to take on more debt than I had to, but I was fortunate enough that, you know, my device was not AI. It was not anything electronic. It's actually kind of beautifully simple, right? It's just stainless steel. So I did not break the bank financing, and I took a line of credit like most all entrepreneurs, but I did not. But once I realized I was onto something, I didn't seek out a third party investor.
Yeah. That
makes sense. I did initially, but again, you've got to know a certain language to get in the door, right, of someone who makes a decision. And I'd say that's half the battle, just to get someone's ear who has some vision and understands kind of the economic power of what you're talking about. And that took me quite a while to do.
Yeah. What was the difference? And, you know, obviously, what a surgeon does and what you do day to day sounds very different than building a company and building a product. So how did you exercise that muscle or build that ability to speak that language? And is there any advice you can give to others who are kind of in a similar path?
Some, you know, I don't mind sharing with you, Eddie. I went through college and med school and residency, and I think I had the basic economics, but I had maybe two or three business classes.
Yeah.
You know, so like most people like me, you know, they train us and they send us out into the woods to get whatever to the wolves of the business world. But when I knew I was going to found the company and I knew I was going to create this, take it to market, I actually went back and got an MBA.
Okay.
Just so I could learn a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of putting a company together and running it. And also so I didn't get, you know, so I didn't lose my shirt in the process. It was worth it for me, that experience. Not necessarily the initials, right? But the experience, I learned a lot. It was helpful.
So in the medical device industry, I don't know how the MBA was weighted necessarily, but obviously the medical device industry has this big regulatory component. So I'm curious how you shored up that gap in your knowledge or any advice you have to those, you know, from that standpoint.
You know, I really don't have any advice. I paid an FDA consultant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I overpaid like everybody else does.
But, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just reality, right? It's just what you do. But no, we had a quality. We paid a consultant to list us with the FDA and get our product approved and whatnot. And then we create a quality system manual, and, you know, we kept it tight, and there wasn't a lot to, you know, we're a little tiny micro company. So once we got the nuts and bolts of it together, we could manage that internally ourselves.
Yeah. You know, I actually think that's one of the things that you might be downplaying it a little bit, but I think something you said in there is actually really powerful. If you keep it tight as a small company, what I've noticed is I've actually talked to other companies that may be the same size, but they have somebody who worked at Medtronic or worked at Stryker. And so whether they pirated those SOPs or pirated that quality manual, now they've got a 40-page quality manual that is just overshooting everything they need to do. But what you said there is actually really powerful. You built what you needed for, maybe overpaid for it, and I hate to hear that, but if you build what you need rather than just borrowing from somebody else, that actually usually works out better. So So
yeah, we created our system organically under that consultant. And I'm kind of joking about we overpaid. Yeah. They did a good job for us. But no, it was a good experience. And I would say it seems to me, I started this as a one-trick pony, right? I knew exactly, took me a while to get there. But once I had that device and once I figured out how to make it applicable to all body habituses, right? Kids, adults, large people, small people. Once I figured that out, I thought this is going to fly. And I just stayed focused with that. And what put me over the edge really and started gathering attention of other companies, larger companies, kept going to these conferences and surgeons would come up to me and said, hey, do you have anything that I can do a wrist arthroscopy with? Is there somewhere you can make this so I can do wrist arthroscopy because I hate my wrist tower? And I've been thinking about that in the back of my head for a while. But honestly, that was pretty easy just to bolt on. I mean, I spent a little time designing it, but when we went from just an elbow product to an elbow and wrist, basically covering everything from the mid-humerus to the fingertips, anything you need to do to an arm, you can do it with this device. It's the only, and then it became the only arm positioner that I'm aware of still now to date that's designed exclusively for surgery from the mid-humerus to the fingertips.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things out there that have multiple attachments. Yeah, you can hold a knee with it or you can hold an arm and do a shoulder. You can bolt it on the forearm and kind of, you know, jerry-rig it and make it work for an elbow. But as far as something that's only designed for arm surgery distal to the shoulder, it's the only device out there.
I read something recently that successful startups are the ones who say there's a shop down the street that the door sticks every time someone opens and closes it. And people just say, man, that door always sticks. And they just get irritated with it. And then a woodworker comes through and says, all you got to do is plane the bottom off and you got this fixed. So what's the difference in everybody who walked through that door and the woodworker? Well, the woodworker works with that thing all the time and he recognizes the need and fixes the need. So what you saw was there was this issue, there was a problem, and you're just, for some reason, you're not willing to just put up with the existing tools. You say, well, I'm just going to fix this. So I'm sure there are others out there who have those sticking points. How do you get them to turn that part of their brain on to where they recognize those pain points? Any thoughts?
Well, you know, for me, even coming out of residency, I thought in the first, I saved these back the napkin sketches of this thing that would never have worked. But I saved them coming out of residency. And I thought, well, industry is going to solve my problem. You've got all these bright people in these large companies. They are going to make an arm system for elbow surgery that works great. And time went by, and as no one paid any attention to the elbow marketplace, I just got more and more frustrated with it. And I think a lot of other people and surgeons out there, they'll get to a point where they just decide to, hey, I'm going to do something about it.
Yeah.
And there is a little bit of risk. I mean, it could have been a big failure, but I was pretty sure I knew there was nothing else out there that did what this thing did. And I knew there were enough people like me that would use it if they just became aware of it. But it was, you know, and I may have already said this, but I definitely felt like a voice in the wilderness the first couple of years. No, I'm not the only one out there who even cares about this, right?
So you went through the licensing and then building your own company and doing it slowly with your own capital. Was there any advice or do you ever that ran counter to that, like get funding or anything like that versus, I mean, you mentioned maybe even trying to get funding at one point. What convinced you to say, well, I'm just going to do this myself? Or I don't know.
I didn't. You know, the main thing, it's all timeliness. And I would say that because we've been on the market since 14. And I did an email campaign and I went to I had a booth at a conference every year, usually the hand conference. And I went to the trauma conference a couple of times. So these companies knew we were out there. I would just say there was very little interest in the elbow world.
Mm, wow.
At least initially. And I would liken it to foot and ankle surgery 20 years ago.
Okay.
20 years ago, there was really nothing sexy about foot and ankle surgery. You know, yeah. But fast forward to 10 years ago, and then you've got these companies like Ortho Helix and now Paragon and these other companies that are solely foot and ankle, you know, their surgeons love their products, ankle replacements. Every company's trying to come up with an ankle replacement now, which when I trained, they weren't even done, or they had a terrible track record, but now the implants have improved. And I really think the next 10 years, elbow surgery is going to see that same kind of evolution.
Okay. Now, if I understand right, you sold your some IP. Is that accurate? Or what was the next step for you? How did that work?
I started, once we hit a certain, you know, market, whatever, capture rate, started getting a couple of calls from these companies asking about things. And I got a couple of offers to sell the company or to buy the company, rather buy the IP. And what I ended up doing was I kept the company, but I did sell my inventory and I did sell my IP, which was 7 issued patents, utility patents, not design patents. And then I sold the logo and the little tagline that went with the device.
Okay. And what's the difference in a, just from my own ignorance, a design patent versus a utility patent?
Utility patents refer to the function.
Okay.
Device versus a design patent. Say, I talk about that thread pitch on a screw earlier, right?
Yeah.
So you take an existing screw and you modify a little bit and you change these variances and the design is a little bit different. Sometimes you can get a quote, you know, a design patent based just on that. So no one can go and reproduce that exact same screw, but they can still do something else to it. So utility patents, at least in my experience, companies put a lot more weight on those, easier to defend and more, or just more financially valuable.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sounds more powerful. What would be the next step then? Do you have other thoughts or ideas that you're perhaps going to pursue, or have you scratched this itch and you're done?
Well, so the elbow arm positioner was my first old kind of obsession, I guess. But I've had this other thing in the back of my mind that I started another process a few months ago. So maybe I'll have more to tell you here in the months ahead. No, it's the same kind of process. You get pick out a problem that exists that someone other than you thinks is a problem, right?
Yeah.
Not to get too infatuated with yourself, right? But try to pick out a problem that should be pretty simple to fix. See the marketplace, and there's so much stuff out there that's in the case I'm working on now that I think is so much over-engineered. You know, we just need to make things simpler so the adoption rate is accelerated and so forth. So that's where I'm now. I've got a few metal prototypes that I'm working with and I'm experimenting with them. And then, you know, another FDA filing, a couple of patents have been filed on this. So it's the standard process, but this is a little bit different because this will be less expensive to bring to market than my arm positioner system will.
Okay. Now that's really exciting. I can't wait. I'll have to have a follow-up. Maybe I'll just have another surgery and we can talk about it.
Surgery. Yeah, but you know, and kind of like beforehand, you come to a fork in the road when you've got an idea, and particularly have a prototype, like a proof of concept model, right? In my world, it's a proof of concept model. And once you get that, you do come to a fork in the road and you have to look at it financially. You know, how much is this the real deal? Are other surgeons, in my case, going to like it? Can I fund this development myself or do I need an equity partner? And then do you sell part of it and let a company take it, or do you take it to market yourself? If I could have sold my arm positioner back in 2014, I would have done it, no doubt.
Yeah.
But it worked out tremendously better that I didn't. But I would have if there was any interest whatsoever, Eddie, and I probably would have.
That's a long time, you know, 10 years basically, you know, that to get to this point. Maybe it's a few years ago that you sold the IP, but
right.
What if there's someone else, like let's say there's someone else at the Tennessee Orthopedic Alliance, I think I said the name incorrectly earlier.
Yeah.
Maybe they have some ideas. What advice do you give them when they come to you and say, hey, I've thought about this? Do you say, go get a, show me how serious you are with a patent, or what kind of advice do you give them?
Yeah, you know, I try to encourage them to try to learn what they don't know. Cause that's always, you know, we surgeons are everybody, particularly surgeons, it seemed like we are quick to jump to assumptions, right? Something in our training just makes it so if A happened, B happened, then C is obviously going to happen next. But in the business world, that's not always the case. So I'd say be prepared to spend some money and just understand what you don't know. And just because you think it's a good idea doesn't always make it a good idea. You need to get some feedback from your peers before you invest a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into a concept that maybe it's going to be fantastic, but the numbers are the numbers. You know, it's likely that it may not be.
Yeah. You know, that feedback is hard to take sometimes. And when I say hard to take, I don't mean like I pridefully don't want to hear it, but it's almost as if we literally have a filter up where we hear the things that are positive and the negative is just, it just goes run through. Is there a way to really teach that to actually sink in, or any thoughts there?
No, I think, well, again, it's like Thomas Edison failed, 100 times before he made the light bulb or something right. Like that. Learned 100 ways or 1,000 ways not to do it. Yeah. I think failure helps. And again, I was fortunate enough to fail early. So then you get some realizations, well, maybe I can learn something from all these people that I'm talking to. But I would still say the trick is understanding maybe that you don't have a crystal ball and you're not exactly sure how far it was going to go. Some years ago, I remember vividly, I woke up about 2 a.m. with this epiphany of how I was going to make this device. I was struggling with how the different arm sizes, heights of people, I had all the measurements down because I'd record a bunch of measurements. And how do you make that arm positioner work for, say, a 6'8" basketball player and a, you know, a 4'10" little elderly lady, right? And make it fit all in one autoclavable disposable tray, right? So you got constraints in there. And when I woke up and I started diagramming that and I knew I was onto something, honestly, I thought I'd sell that company within the next calendar year. It didn't work out, but I learned a lot about the process. And I'm sure a lot of people thought I had no idea what I was doing. And I probably didn't in the early stages, but you know, you learn a lot as time goes by if you keep your eyes open and kind of listen more and talk less.
I think that's a good lesson that if I could just kind of rephrase it into my own words, that failing fast, again, it's one of those lessons that you wash, you think, okay, and it washes over you. But at the same time, I remember when I was writing articles, I would write an article and I thought, man, this isn't any good, but I have to write an article a week. So the guy I was reporting to said, listen, you know why we write this article? So we can write next week's article. And sometimes I think maybe that's a similar idea. You know, you fail fast. We're going to get to this failure because you can't get to the success without going through the failure. We all like to think, well, if I'd done this differently, I would go straight to the success, but maybe you actually wouldn't. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. Again, that early experience, it helped me peel back the layers of the onion and see what was wrong with my concept. Mm-hmm. And once I eliminated all the esoteric things and got focused on it needs to do this, it just became easier. So while I was disappointed initially with that, I realized I just had to stop the licensing agreement and go on and do my own thing. You know, but again, it was you got to handle rejection pretty well. I would say all surgeons or physicians or whatever want to be in the medical device business, right? I mean, it seems to me that's everybody think that's really cool and glamorous and all that. And it is after the close, right?
Yeah. Right.
But when you're working there in the booth at the big conference, you know, on two kind of lousy chairs with not much booth traffic initially, I promise you, Eddie, it's not that sexy, right? And you're eating that cold sandwich and everybody else is going and having fun. You're sitting there manning the booth all day. It's a lot sexy. And that's fun. And it's enjoyable engaging other physicians and talking about showing your stuff, right? But it's a heck of a lot sexier after the close.
Yeah. And I could totally see that. And that is an interesting observation that a lot of people, I'm sure you get a lot more of that traffic now from people saying, oh, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that, and talking about it. Can you talk a little bit about the failures that you're describing? Not everybody is willing to talk about the failures. I think it's interesting that you keep bringing that up as really one of the pillars of your background. Is there any of that stand out as specific?
Well, I'd say, you just can't be afraid to fail.
Yeah.
You know, and if the surgeon comes up and says, well, I like this, but I don't really like this or this, you know, you can't take that as a personal offense, right?
Yeah.
Take it as, hey, I appreciate you giving me some honest feedback on it. We want to hear positive feedback all the time, right? Because the negative feedback sometimes kind of hurts, or you want to discount it, right? Like, oh, that's not really right. You know, people think like I do. But I think the negative feedback is a heck of a lot more valuable than the positive feedback most of the time.
Was there any specific negative feedback that comes to mind? I mean, I'm sure it probably, sometimes that stuff stings a little bit, but that, is there any piece that you feel like, oh, I hated to hear that in the moment, but it was actually really valuable? I'm curious if you have any, if there's anything you can share.
It's like little brief engagements over the conferences, you know.
Yeah.
When you get, say, the older surgeon who comes by and looks at something and say, oh, I would never use that. And I said, well, why would you not use that? He said, well, I do this, and I always do them like this. Well, it's more kind of understanding where that reference came from. And then when you learn that, again, it's not knowing what you don't know. When you come to find out that he did two elbow surgeries last year, you know, versus 200, right? It's all, I would say it all seems to be trying to understand what their perspective is.
Yeah.
It's, a lot of times it's not the same as your own.
So we have a lot of quality and regulatory and first-time founders in the audience and quite a few other types of vendors and people like that. So I don't know how many of them reach out to speakers, but I am curious, starting a new thought or new venture, are there any specific things you're looking for? Not to try to get you inundated, but I can see two types of people. The people who listen to this podcast are probably some of the best who do this, but also others who want to get advice. What kinds of, I guess, brain power are you looking for in the future to shore up ideas?
Well, I would say, yeah, I was fortunate enough that my day job really, my medical device company was just aimed at making my day job better.
Yeah.
So I did not give up my day job. And I think that's really what helped power me through as far as things that I get excited about with innovation and talking to other surgeons. I don't want to see something that's just a differential pitch on a screw, right?
Yeah.
I want to see something that either makes patient outcomes, you know, demonstrably better, saves me time, makes the operation more, makes the process more efficient. That's just what I want. And if you can tell me that it's faster and patient outcomes are better and it's not exorbitantly expensive, I'm all for that.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know, that sounds simple, but it's tough to find.
Huh.
So that's what I want, somebody who's passionate about, you know, this brings up the term value-based healthcare. And sometimes I see that's such a misnomer, if you will, or a bastardized term, if you don't mind me kind of saying. But things that actually streamline the process, make outcomes better, particularly something that makes things easier for physicians, because we have there's so much noise and interference with physicians' practice every day. It seems like we have a new regulation or a new fee or another haggle with an insurance company. Every day it's something, right? So anything that makes the process better, less onerous, improve patient outcomes, and makes the process more efficient, that's going to be a winner.
Yeah. Yeah, if someone's about to cut my foot open, I would hope that they're not just going to really have to be getting into the right position should be the last thing in their mind, I would hope. But I know it's
right. And honestly, Ed, and if you've got the all things being equal, your outcome being the same, you know, you want the medical procedure that's quickest, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you got a choice between being under an anesthetic for an hour or under an anesthetic for 30 minutes, for example, with the same outcome, right? I would take the 30-minute anesthetic procedure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I can think of Steve Jobs. I said simple is harder. Simple is the hardest or whatever.
Yeah.
Simpler is harder than complex or something like that. So that's what I'm after. And that's what I try to seek out in vendors that come to me with our medical practice to sell us items. Is it going to be easier for our staff to use? Is it going to make their job simpler? Because they have a lot on their plate too. So that's really what I look for. And honestly, okay. I look for stuff that's kind of easy. simple and relatively quick ROI.
Okay.
What are the barriers to entry? How hard is it? How hard is it going to be to get to our end point?
Yeah.
And then I try to keep it just kind of simple, which sounds silly to say, but it's tougher than you might think.
No, I believe it. One last question about the self-funded. I know there's lots of pros and cons. Would you do it the same way again, or do you have the thoughts or advice? Have things changed since 2014 in your mind, or it's still possible if you do it a certain way? Any pros and cons?
You know, I would just encourage all the startups out there to hold on to your equity as much as you can, as long as you can, because there'll be plenty of opportunities to give away or sell that equity, you know, down the line. You know, the interest rate climate is a lot worse now than it was back when I had my first company line of credit. So that kind of changes the climate a little bit.
Yeah.
So I don't have any financing words of wisdom, really. I would say, you know, work with partners that you can trust, have all your non-disclosures signed up front. You know, again, don't assume that everybody around you has necessarily good intentions, or is just check out your references and things like that before you enter into a business relationship with somebody, which sounds silly and simple, but it seems sometimes that's not necessarily done correctly.
Well, especially if you get a lot of no's in the beginning and then someone says, yes, I can see you being excited about that.
Well, right. I mean, you get kind of desperate, right?
If
you're into something, you're super passionate about it, you get turned down by the three or four kind of class A people that you go to. Well, then you start going down to the B's and the C's, and it is nice to resist that temptation. But I would say hold on to your equity as long as you can. If you have the opportunity, don't give up your day job until you're really sure you got a winner.
Awesome. Well, any last piece of advice for those listening, whether it's first-time founders, anyone in the medical device industry, any last piece of advice before we close?
Well, I just say have faith in yourself, and if you're passionate about something, you know, believe in it, but also understand the situation, understand your concept, how it fits into the marketplace, and understand the your allies and your adversaries. Because not everyone's going to be your ally. Even if you've got a terrific idea, you're going to get resistance from people. And just try to get a good vibe for the least painful path to success, and just go with your gut.
It makes sense. Really appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your story, and I look forward to potentially seeing you again one of these days. But I appreciate your willingness to come on the podcast. Those you've been listening to the podcast, you've been listening to the Global Medical Device Podcast. We'll put some links in the show notes so they can find your organization and maybe reach out.
And thanks so much. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for having me. And feel free to share a link to my website, huntermed.net. They can contact me through there if there's any questions. I'm to help and talk about it.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Hunter. We'll see you all next
time. Thanks so much.
Everybody. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, can I ask a special favor from you? Can you leave us a review on iTunes? I know most of us have never done that before, but if you're listening on the phone, look at the iTunes app, scroll down to the bottom where it says leave a review. It's actually really easy. Same thing with the computer. Just look for that leave a review button. This helps others find us, and it lets us know how we're doing. Also, I'd personally love to hear from you on LinkedIn. Reach out to me. I read and respond to every message, because hearing your feedback is the only way I'm going to get better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.